Good morning. It's my privilege to introduce to you today our guest speaker, David Timms. I first got acquainted with David about a half a dozen years ago when he worked with Corey DeWitt at Hope University, and I began reading his books. He's written four of them and his blog called Because of Grace. You should check it out. And I found his work to be stimulating and encouraging and deeply sold. And so we are very grateful he is here with us today. He's the Dean of the School of Theology at William Jessup University up north. He's married to Kim, who is also here with us, who is the sister of Steve Welch, who's married to Helen, who attends our church. So that's pretty cool, too. We're happy about all those connections. He has three boys, and he is from Australia. So not only does he have like a really cool accent that you're going to totally enjoy, but he has a fresh perspective on American culture and what it means to follow Jesus. So would you please give a warm welcome to David Timms.
Thanks, Heidi. Well, good morning, everybody. I am just delighted to be with you this morning, and what a pleasure and a privilege it is for me to be able to share some thoughts with you. I apologize for the accent. I've been working on it for years. It's just lingering, you know. Kim tolerates it. The rest of you try and understand it, and I just do what I can with it, so we're stuck. It is what it is this morning, but really pleased to be with you. And what a marvelous series to start a new year with, Recovering Life. What are we up to today? Is the 10th of January, at least my watch says so, already? New Year's resolutions have probably already come and gone for some of us, but it's not too late to say, hey, 2016, really want to recover life. I want to live differently this year than last year. Now, I imagine most of us, many of us, would have started the year, if not making resolutions, at least just quietly hoping that maybe there could be some changes. So I'm thrilled to be here to share in this series. Hey, our family is a Muppet family. Anyone else like the Muppets? There's a handful of us. So we're Muppet people, and the Muppets Most Wanted opened with a great song. The song was simply, we're doing a sequel. We're back by popular demand. No one else is singing this with me. All right, let's go straight to the refrain, shall we? I thought it was the end, but no, my friend, this is when we get to do it all again. Do it all again. Okay, that's the end of my Broadway career. I was going to test that out today. Kim's never told me never sing in church again, and maybe I won't. Wouldn't we like to do that with life sometimes? Wouldn't we like just to take some of the things that have happened to us, some of the habits that we formed, some of the hurts we experience, some of the things we've been through, and just put it in a can, put it away, and just do it all again? Wouldn't it be nice if we could start over? I wonder what you would say if I simply asked you to finish this statement. If I could do it all again, one thing I'd change is... I hear people say things, one thing I'd change is I wouldn't get married so young. Maybe I would have married someone different. I wouldn't have spent money the way I spent money. I wouldn't have been so busy. I would change my priorities. I'd get some help if I could just do it all again. We'd all like to recover life. Just get it back. Some of us, not all of us, but some of us even this morning kind of feel like life's just getting away from us a tad. Last week, Dave Simbora shared a really helpful message on anxiety and depression. I got to listen to it online. Isn't that the beauty of online? You had to come here. I sat in my office up north on Wednesday and just listened to it. It was great. You know, I sipped coffee. You can't do that. It was wonderful to be able to listen to last week's message on depression and anxiety. Powerful message, even birthed partly out of his own experience. One of the two-headed monsters that many of us face. And for a few moments this morning, I want to touch on one of the other two-headed monsters that we face and probably perhaps all of us face. And that is the beast of busyness and stress. I was born before the technological revolution. Funny to say that, makes me feel really ancient, right? But the revolution is that young. The digital age. I remember my dad coming home and bringing home to our home in Australia the first colour television. I can still remember that. I remember a day in the 70s, he came in and he had this calculator. It was the size of two cigar boxes. It was about this big and this fat. It looked like a cash register. And he said, "I've got this thing called a calculator." And we're all like, wow, right? We started talking about just how technology is going to change our lives for the better. It was going to be this glorious thing that we would embrace technology and we would have less work and less stress. Exactly. Time magazine, in their issue just before Christmas, had a short little piece in it that tells me that every one of you, at least on average, every one of you here this morning, checks your phone 46 times a day. Now, some of you look at each other like, "I don't." Well, that means the person beside you does twice as much, right? Between us, 46 times a day. I thought technology was supposed to serve us. And we've become slaves to our technology. We now call it an addiction, even at times. If we've learned anything in the last 30 years, it's simply that busyness and stress are conditions of the heart. They are not the result of our circumstances. John Ortberg, in his book, The Life You've Always Wanted, it's been out a while now, but he writes, "Hurry is not just a disordered schedule. Hurry is a disordered heart." I'm not sure I want to hear that, but I think he's right. We might rightly say that busyness and stress are at all-time high levels among us. Might be true for my life too. One of the problems I've got with busyness is the definition of busyness. So here's a definition I found. Never mind the thing on the right. I'm so busy, I don't know if I found a rope or lost a horse. Some of us are that busy, right? But how about this definition on the left? That busy is a state of having a lot of activity or of not being idle. Okay. But let's show of hands. Let's do a poll together. How many of you, if I use the word idle, how many of you think of that word as a positive versus how many of you think of the word idle as a negative? So those of you, when I say idle, hey, you are an idle person. Is that a positive? Hands up. You're all by yourself. I'm sorry. What about a negative? Yeah, see, that's the problem right there. Because I don't want you to think I'm idle. You know, you'll never call me and talk to me and say, "Hey, David, you know, what you up to?" "Nothing, I'm just idle." Never going to say that. "Well, aren't you doing anything?" "No, I'm being really lazy." "It's great. You should try it." Right? I don't want to be idle. I don't want to be lazy in your eyes. And in my mind, because this is how our culture defines things, then my only option is to be busy. And the busier I am, the better. Because if I'm a very busy person, I must be an important person. If my schedule is out of control, I must be someone for you to look up to. And I certainly never want to be idle or lazy. And that's my problem. See, busy is good in my mind. Busy is honorable. Busy is productive. Busy is a virtue. It's just that busy is a cancer. How do we walk with Jesus if we are running through life? I don't have an answer for that. How do we walk by the Spirit when we spend most of our days rushing from one place to the next? I remember years ago being floored by something that Eugene Peterson wrote. He was writing a book for pastors, but the book has such broader application than that. This is what he had to say as part of his words. He said, "The word busy is the symptom not of commitment, but of betrayal. It is not devotion, but defection. The adjective busy, set as a modifier to the word pastor, should sound to our ears like adulteress to characterize a wife or embezzling to describe a banker." Well, not really. It is an outrageous scandal, a blasphemous affront. In fact, in the broader context, he said when he gets mail addressed to the busy pastor, it goes straight in the trash can because he doesn't want to honor anyone who would dishonor his life in that way. Really? See, many of us think of busy as a positive. Peterson goes on and says there's two reasons why we're busy. Most of us are busy, first of all, because we're vain. We're vain. The busier we are, the more important we are. The busier we are, the more people think highly of us. Imagine going into a doctor's office. You know, you got an illness, an ailment that you need to have fixed, and you go into the doctor's office, there's nobody there. No one's sitting there, and you look through the door, and you can see the doctor sitting in a chair just leafing through Sports Illustrated or something. What are you going to do with the doctor? Well, I'm going to take my sickness and go find another doctor. That's probably what I'm going to do. I want to find a waiting room where people are sneezing and coughing and spluttering and falling on the floor and carrying. I want to find a waiting room where there are bodies everywhere because that doctor must be good. People will line up and they'll wait for him or for her. Oh yeah, that's the doctor I want. And I'll complain about the fact that my appointment was 45 minutes ago. Where are you? Right? But I want the busy doctor. And because this is the way we think of the word busy, we make ourselves busy. But it's vanity. It's about being vain. Peterson goes on and says the second reason we're so busy is, in fact, because we are so lazy. There's an irony to this. He says we let others decide our agenda. Others control our time. Others manage our lives. We are too lazy to be resolute to take charge of our own lives. Well, thank you, Dr. Peterson. That sounds all very harsh, and I'm sure that doesn't relate to my busy life much at all. Alan Fadling has written a book. He's a friend of mine, wrote a book a couple of years ago called An Unhurried Life. I'm pleased to say it's taken me a very long time to read it. It should. But he recalls a conversation at the start of that book in which Dallas Willard, when he was alive, asked folk to choose a word to describe Jesus. If I asked you to choose a word to describe Jesus, what word would it be? Some of us would choose very similar words, and I can even guess what some of those words would be. Teacher. We'd say that he is great. We'd say he is loving. We'd say all these other things about Jesus. Willard chose the word relaxed. Relaxed? I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have thought of Jesus as unhurried or unbusy or relaxed. That's not the word that would have come to my mind, but that is the word that actually characterizes his life, isn't it? I mean, he waits until he's 30 years of age to begin a public ministry. He's come to save the world. None of us are on a mission that important in life. Oh, yes, that's right. There was that moment when he was about 12 in the temple where he confounded the religious leaders and spoke to them and asked profound questions for a couple of days when he got separated from the family. You remember the story. But after that, he goes into a cocoon again for 18 years. You know what we would have done with Jesus if this had happened? Somebody would have caught it on a phone, a smartphone for sure, right? Watching him ask these profound questions. And they would have uploaded it to YouTube. There'd be 500,000 hits because everybody's amazed. Wow, this 12-year-old, he just runs circles around the theologians, right? And everybody's watching it and everybody's impressed. And then we'd grab this young kid and we'd put him on a speaking circuit because he is a child prodigy. Get him out there. Show him off. Let people see him. Get him started. Waste no time. Not Jesus. Now in my father's time, when I'm 30, I'll start a public ministry, unhurried. Challenges the way I think of busyness in my own life. And then there's this thing called stress. If we could measure it, I would guess that we would have enough stress among us this morning to sink a ship. And I would add my share to that, I've no doubt. And there are various equations we could use. I'm not very good at math, and so I don't know if this equation works or not. But this would be the little equation I'd use, that fear plus worry equals stress. not in every case and for everybody, and there are stresses that are unrelated to this sort of thing, but for the most part, the more afraid I am, the more stressed I am. We have enough fear to sink a ship in our culture right now. Fear produces enormous stress. Consider some of the dominant fears that are just below the surface, even for many of us. Some of us are terribly afraid of terrorism. In fact, I have to stop watching political candidates right now. Because if I listen too much to the political candidates, I will become afraid of every Muslim and every refugee in this world. Every one of them, notice, not us, every one of them is a danger to me. I've got to stop listening to that stuff. We're afraid of losing our jobs. I don't know, maybe you're here this morning thinking, I already know when I go to work tomorrow. That'll be my last day at work. Last Monday I showed up at work and there was an email to say that one of my colleagues, that was his last day at work. Wow. It's a hard way to start the year. We're afraid of how we'll ever pay off the Christmas bills. Well, we had a great time, but now the fear sets in because as soon as that statement arrives in the mail, I've got to find a way to pay it. And I feel sick about it. Christmas was fun, but now I've got to pay for it in many ways. We're afraid of rejection and failure. That's a lifelong thing for some of us. We're afraid of what others might say about us. We're afraid of our homes. Yeah, some of us are afraid of our homes. I know that. Kim and I have been involved with some parents this last 6 months in a group where tremendous pain and fear of their homes. One dad says, hey, my kid is so out of control. So out of control, I don't even want to call home when I'm at work because I just can hardly face listening to my wife start telling me again what's happening today. It's just easier for me to have no communication with my wife till I get home, and then I'll just handle it when I get there. And she's like, why don't you call home? I've got to deal with what he's doing, how he's treating me, what he's saying to me, and you're nowhere to be found. Yeah, this home is hardly a haven. This home is a place of pain and brokenness, and some of us are afraid of our homes. I know that. Some of us are afraid of taking those exams. They're coming up quick. Some of us are afraid of divorce. You know, divorce is one of the top fears of teenagers today. Not their own divorce, of course, but the divorce of their parents. When you dig deep, you look at the surveys now, in the top three or four fears of teenagers is the fear of divorce. Every day wondering, I wonder if my parents are going to go that route. We're afraid of what the doctor might say if we make that visit. So I'm not going to make that visit even if there's nobody in that waiting room. It's just not going to go. We're afraid of being alone. We're afraid of death. And each fear and each level of each fear adds to our collective stress. And before we know it, we have a mountain in front of us and it feels like a mountain on top of us. I'm busy and stressed. And here's the question as we kind of pull all these threads together this morning. How do we recover our lives and discover peace and joy in the midst of such busyness and stress? Well, there's a little story in Luke chapter 10, and I want to take just a couple of minutes with it. In Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42, it's five verses long. Some scholars think that what Luke is doing is beginning to make a transition, that this is a new movement in the ministry of Jesus. If that be true, then the first story of a new movement is kind of an important one, isn't it? And so I pay attention especially to this little story. Luke is the only one who tells us this little story. It's a story some of you would know, and here's how it goes. I'll just move forward to it, and we'll have a look at it together. Maybe we'll look at it together. Maybe we won't. If I can't. Oh, there's all sorts of things happening here. You know what? I'd like you to see the text, so let me just get to it. There it is. And here's how it goes. Jesus and his disciples are on their way. They're on their way, and he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. It's a simple little story. We know that this village is probably the village of Bethany. And as the story unfolds, we'll see that she has a sister named Mary. Martha is probably the older sister because it's described as her home. And the village is Bethany. It's about 2 miles from Jerusalem, we know from other places in Scripture. And it really is a village. We shouldn't think of it as a city or a town. You should think, maybe there's 100 people, 150 people who live in this little village. It's just a handful of homes. It's all it is. And there's a couple of sisters, and they happen to have a brother. Some of you would know the brother's name. His name is Lazarus, right? John tells us about him later, and much later in the ministry of Jesus, Lazarus dies and Jesus raises him from the dead. But it's Martha, it's Mary, and their brother Lazarus. I don't know where the rest of the family is. Maybe it's just the 3 siblings. But it's Martha who says, hey, Jesus, stop here. We want to open our home to you. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. Sounds all right. Verse 40, but Martha was distracted by all the preparations that she had to make. That word distracted has the idea of she allowed her attention to wander. I imagine she wanted to sit down and listen to Jesus too. Would have been so nice to just sort of take a few moments and just plop down and listen to Jesus. But immediately, hey, here is this rabbi. Here's this famous person. He's stopping by our house. Oh, my goodness, we should serve a meal. What have I got in the kitchen? What have I got in the cupboards? What can I whip together? I've got to start thinking about this. Somebody's got to start thinking about this. Somebody's got to show hospitality. Somebody's got to be gracious. You know how it goes, right? Her mind is racing along distracted. That's to put it mildly. Some of you ladies know how this goes. Us guys don't tend to so much. Right? I want to show hospitality. It's the right thing to do, and it needs to be done the right way. And so here she is inviting Jesus in, and she's distracted, and off she goes, and she starts to get things ready. And then she comes back. Now she's starting to get a little upset. Does this happen at all over Christmas? You know? Mum's in the kitchen and she's doing all the cooking and all the preparation and some of the dishes and some of the cleaning, and she's doing it all by herself, and everybody's in the other room and they're talking and they're laughing and they're having a good time, and it's like, I could really use some help here, people, but I don't want to say that because to say that would be ungracious. I don't want people to think that I'm ungracious, so I will just fume and and boil here on my own so that they will think I'm a gracious host, but I am not enjoying this. I want to be there, not here, but this has to happen because who's going to cook the meal if I don't cook? You know how it goes. We have this experience. It's almost an everyday experience sometimes. Not in my home, but I mean in our homes, right? That's exactly what Martha's experiencing. And she is so head up about things that she comes now in verse 40 and she says to Jesus, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? What's this got to do with Jesus? He's the guest. I don't want to get between you two sisters. You just take it out with her. You know, sort it out with her on your own. She now not only wants to accuse Mary, she wants to accuse Jesus of not having stepped in and somehow or other pushed Mary to the kitchen. Mary, you go help your sister for a while. There's this little conflict. It's one of life's simplest conflicts, one of life's most common conflicts. Tell her to help me, says Martha. I've had enough. I want some help. I want some support. This is all about you, Jesus, and we're trying to do this for you. And then here's how the text continues. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered. When I was a boy, my mother would sometimes say, David Thames, right? Because I have a first and a last name. Martha doesn't have a last name that I know of. David Thames, come here right now. And that was a moment of decision. It was a moment where you decided to really head for the hills and never come here at all, or to come very, very quickly, because Mum had a seriousness about her voice. And the Scripture is exactly the same way. Anytime Jesus repeats a word, truly, truly, or a name, Martha, Martha, it's to denote a great seriousness about the moment. Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things. Well, you're dead right. I'm worried and upset about a lot of things. Don't you have any sense of what there is to be upset and worried about right now? I mean, I don't know if you like Brussels sprouts. I don't know if you like broccoli. We haven't asked. I don't know if you're vegetarian, Jesus. Do you eat chicken? I don't know. I don't know what you like to eat. I don't know all these things. Yeah, I feel justly stressed about this whole situation. Verse 42. Martha, a few things are needed. Indeed, only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it shall not be taken away from her. Only one thing is needed, and Mary got that one thing right. Martha is a friend of Jesus. She loves him. She respects him. She wants to honor him. She wants to serve him. She wants to do the right thing for him. But she got it wrong. And in her mind, the time to listen to Jesus was when the duties of the day were done. Friends, I want to suggest to you that the solution to busyness and stress, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but we ought not miss the foundational piece. The solution to our busyness and our stress is not 10 steps to this or 20 steps to that. It's to do what Mary did, and it's simply to come over and over and over and over and over again to the feet of Jesus. Martha had invited Jesus into the family home. She had intended to serve him and do well, and then she got busily preparing this meal. Mary, her sister, just sits at his feet. Let me press on past here. My last slide. How many of us do the same? How many of us have invited Jesus into our home, our lives, and then said, Jesus, now I'll just get busy. I'll just start doing this for you, and I'll just start doing that for you. And Jesus says, just sit at my feet. Jesus, I'd like to do that, but you know I've got a busy work life, and that's how I support my family. That's how I support the church, your kingdom. I've got to be busy about those things, and the busyness produces its stress, but I will at some point sit down and listen to you. Jesus, you know I'd like to sit at your feet, but right now you've given me three little kids, right? I can't help it if the youngest one's teething and wants to stay up all night. I'm exhausted. We're all exhausted. Kids are not well, and I'm trying to deal with their moods and their temperaments and everything else that's going on. Jesus, when I just get through this small child-rearing phase, I'll sit down at your feet. But you know I want to raise God-fearing, God-honoring kids. So right now, I am just busy and stressed in the process. And what we fail to realize, it's not that we don't raise kids and we don't work. Is that we sit at the feet of Jesus first, not last. And that's why this story in Luke chapter 10 starts the whole next movement in the ministry of Jesus. Picture Mary sitting and listening, and join her in your heart and your mind this year at the feet of Jesus. Pause when the pressure rises, when the crisis looms, when the stress builds, when the busyness mounts, and sit at the feet of Jesus. When you're tempted to reach for comfort food, for distraction, for the TV, for drugs, or alcohol, stop first at the feet of Jesus. When you want to react to a harsh word, before you react to an unkind email, a hurtful comment, a painful rejection, first sit at the feet of Jesus. Before you say yes to another time filler or time killer, take a moment at the feet of Jesus. In the middle of conflict, as fear takes hold, when confusion threatens to swamp you, listen at the feet of Jesus. On the way to the doctor, or the lawyer, or the specialist this week, or the boss, carve out a few minutes, or even if only possible, a few moments to be at the feet of Jesus. Picture him, reach out to him, listen to him, find strength in him, be renewed by him, receive comfort through him. In the car, in the office, at home, in the bedroom or the boardroom, pull up a seat at his feet. Open your ears, open your heart, be attentive, listen, release all else, look only to him, because he has come to us. He has entered our homes. He dwells among us. He abides within us. And he does speak with us. Not with loud or brash words, not with demanding or aggressive tones, not with anger or bitterness, but with grace and gentleness, understanding and peace. Before you head to the kitchen and start working, sit at the feet of Jesus. Read his words. Listen to his words. May this become our breath prayer, our motto, our conviction, our commitment at the feet of Jesus. How shall we recover lives that seem to have been stolen by busyness and stress, maybe even in the first 10 days of 2016? It's not about balance. It's not balancing things. It's about posture. Coming first to the feet of Jesus. This past week, I've been quietly saying that all day, every day. 20, 30, 40 times a day. At the feet of Jesus. And I've been surprised. As I got into the car and said it, I didn't feel the compulsion to turn on the radio. I always turn on the radio. Didn't even want to. At the feet of Jesus. As I walked into a meeting and said it, I felt a different peace and a different expectation, a settledness that moments before hadn't been there, at the feet of Jesus. As I wrote emails this week, and I do way too much of that, and I said it, my soul felt more at rest. And as I have listened to him, he has renewed me, and he will do the same for you. Come this day, this week, this year, in a fresh way, to the feet of Jesus. Let me lead us in prayer. Father, some of us arrived here in this building this morning feeling quite burdened, perhaps even overwhelmed by the busyness and the stress of our lives. There is so much going on. People expect so much. The demands are so high. And we carved out a little time for you before we rush back into the fray. Teach us to pause with you throughout our day. Father, be gracious to us. Heal us, renew us, restore us, and hold us close to yourself as we sit at your feet. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.